I don't know when the last time I did a solo show of the backpack show. I've done it for, you know, some of my other shows like Scratch Pad and all that, but I haven't done the backpack show solo in a long time. I'm supposed to be looking over trying to find Carrie. Where is she? She's not here. But I'm so glad everybody's here. As you know, it is like Fight Club. If you show up at the backpack show and you don't say anything, you don't say hi, you don't comment, I don't know you're here, so you don't get credit. I do not mark you present for the day. We've got quite a day today. We've got Krista Lynch from Brooklyn Braised. She's going to teach us all about business, especially when one decides to go from being a really professional elite events caterer to deciding to open their first ever sit-down restaurant about a week or so before the pandemic shuts down all dining on the planet. So she talks about her pivot and what she did to make the world a better place thereafter. Peter Nieves is going to teach us about law. He's a lawyer, but not only that, but he started a scholarship to help less fortunate people or to get more diversity into law, which I think is really important. His point was that it's really important to get a lot of shining faces into law that aren't just the same old other people. Chloe is here. She says, hi, my biological father, Steve Brogan, joins us. Hello to Carol Aliloff. Kate is here. Thank you. Please, everybody, keep me sane and honest, because Lord only knows what's going to go terribly wrong today.
Hi, everyone. Tim Kitzer from NBA Jam and NFL Blitz, welcoming you to The Backpack Show. Your hosts, Chris Brogan, Kerry Gorgone, Boom Shakalaka.
Backpack Show.
Like I said, Carrie's away on assignment. She'll be back again sometime soon. But I'm going to do my dangest to make it all work. Hey, Linda joining me over on Twitch. Oh, I'm so happy. I'm so happy because we've got to get that Twitch viewership up a little bit. Hey, all my friends who don't use Twitch, get on Twitch. Hey, Leslie, good to see you. Quite a morning this morning. I'm going to start with Krista Lynch. I want to bring her up first. And that means, Peter, if you need to get a beverage or something, go ahead, help yourself, be comfortable. We're going to be fine here. Krista's got her coffee. We know she's fine. So I'm going to bring her on. She runs Brooklyn Braised. We're going to get right into it. Hey, Krista.
Hi, Chris. Good morning.
I'm so glad to have you here. Like I said, I got to push all these buttons. I'm so not used to it. Look, there you are, founder of Brooklyn Braised.
There I am.
So, you know, you started like any, you've been in restaurant business for a long time, you told me, and you started this place with the idea that you're going to be this great catering organization, and then you launched a sit-down restaurant, and then the world shut down around you. Then what?
Yes. Okay, so then what? So we were supposed to sign a lease on a space in February. Obviously, everything shut down here in New York City. I don't know if it shut down harder in New York City than anywhere else, but we were shut down. And feeling really lost, all of my colleagues were actually giving food to frontline workers. And I wanted to support people who were needy and needed food. But I kind of felt like, let my peers do the frontline workers. Let me support people who actually have been displaced from their homes, people who are in shelters, women head of households. So that's where I started at. Now, because at the time I didn't have a kitchen, I thought, like, let me develop some type of business model that could be replicated anywhere. So instead of Brooklyn Braised doing the cooking and putting my staff at risk, why don't we get these partnerships with these other restaurants and have them do the cooking, and Brooklyn Braised will facilitate the entire program, pay for everything, pay for delivery, pay the restaurants for the food, pay for all logistics. We're handling the entire project. The restaurants are cooking the food. And so it was successful. We had our first 8 weeks. An 8 week cycle cost $29,000. We had a very successful 8 weeks, and we are actually fundraising right now for additional funds for more weeks.
Wow. So again, this is you facilitate, you sort of drive the bus, you project manage, but you get a whole bunch of other people to also put their resources towards.
Yeah.
This.
Okay. I mean, we had a fundraiser on the platform iFundWomen because I wanted to raise money, but you know, everybody uses GoFundMe, and I wanted to very much like legitimize the project. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So iFundWomen has this wonderful platform for raising funds. My first grant came from Caress, you know, the Unilever company, the soap company. They gave $2,500. And then, of course, we raised $7,000 in donations. And then because we weren't able to raise the full $29,000, I put the remainder in myself from the business.
That is impressive as heck. You know what else is impressive? I'm not going to lie. I was looking at this and I stopped listening for a second. brioche French toast with brown sugar cranberry sauce.
Well, it's that lover's time is coming up. So we're doing all types of food and cocktails around sexiness and around Valentine's Day.
Krista. Oh my goodness, that looks so delicious. Tell me a little bit about more about this. Tell me my dad just went over to Twitch. Thanks, Dad. Tell me a little bit about the kind of people. What are the projects like now at Brooklyn Braised? Because you're doing a lot of virtual cooking, which is what everybody's doing.
Oh my gosh, we have so much going on. So let me tell you. So Meals and Us, this project, which was launched in May, what I did, because, you know, things start to get very complicated when you start fundraising money. I don't even know how people ask people for all these people on GoFundMe and don't get hit from the IRS. So the first thing I saw, and I want to say in August, I started speaking with legal about how to establish a nonprofit. Mm-hmm. So now I have a nonprofit called Community Cookery. And once we have enough funding from the Robin Hood Foundation to move forward with working with that project, we also want to put together a couple of other educational projects around food, show a family how to feed a family of four for $25, and do nutrition education. So it becomes where people can work with the resources that they have. For example, SNAP works at all the farmers markets in New York City, which a lot of people don't realize. And when you use those tokens that they give you access to more tokens so you can buy more in surplus. Sometimes when I see people in certain communities shopping in actual bodegas, I'm like, why? It's such a waste of money. And that SNAP that they give you does not go very far. Mm-hmm. So really, Community Cookery is going to be about educating people about the finances around food. And then also, in addition to that, making nutritious options.
Sure.
Choices. I'm sorry.
So you got to back me up on this. $25. That's a number. Well,
you know what? This is what the restaurants did. The restaurants that came to me and they said, well, Krista, I said, I want everybody to have enough food that would feed a family of four, even if it's just a mother and her son, mm-hmm. so that they would have food for possibly another meal. The food was delivered to the shelter always in the afternoon, sometime between 1 and 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I said, I want to make sure that there's enough food for a family of four, but we've got to keep it within a really tight budget. Mm-hmm. So I said, how about $25 for a family of four? And the reason I'm saying that is because if you get a roast chicken, some side veg, some beautiful homemade bread, that would be $25. So it's really about how you stretch things. And let me tell you, we had the restaurants Gage and Tomer, which is a historic restaurant in New York City. They were supposed to be reopening themselves.
Yeah.
They came on board as my first partner restaurant. So, you know, wow. The quality of food was outstanding, right? And then we also had another Michelin star restaurant, Alte Kali did, which is in Prospect Heights, which is another amazing restaurant. The quality of the food was better than how I eat. You know, and we want to keep that level up for another cycle. You know what I'm saying? It really did show people this is how we can eat for such a small amount of money. So it really is about the education around not being frivolous around food.
Right. You know, putting the money where it can be used best. And your point is, you know, in bodegas with snacks and things like that, that's a lot of money for not a lot of food.
I was at a local grocery store a few weeks ago and saw an elderly woman. Now, there is a supermarket around the corner, but I think the bodega was at the corner for a block. And she had a bill for $95 at a Ooh. Bodega. She had about maybe 7 or 8 things in her cart. Such a waste. And I was like, why are you not going to the supermarket? Of course, the owner of the bodega was giving me dagger eyes. But it's such a waste. The prices that they have to jack up everything is crazy.
Right. It's crazy time. That's nuts. And then, so again, switching back to the other theme is, you know, we're heading into Valentine's Day. You're going to do some love cooking. You want to talk a little bit about that event? I'm curious. I want to hear, you know, how you.
Okay. So the event is called Bay Time. Bay, you know, like bay before anyone else. Uh-huh. It's designed for couples and it's a 4-course meal. So we're starting out with, the idea around it is that cooking together is a way of creating intimacy with your partner without even touching. Mm-hmm. So we are starting out with a beautiful salad that they're going to be making, a wedge salad. And then, of course, you have the option of your entree. The project itself is supposed to have a steak. And you have the choice of 4 different cuts of steak. And I give examples of the cuts of steak in a video. And then if you are pescatarian, you can have a beautiful brown butter Dover sole filet.
Nice.
And you've got your side. So we have a jalapeno mashed potato, and then we have some braised Swiss chard greens with shiitake mushrooms. And then we also have a peach pie dessert. Peaches are supposed to be great also to kind of get those sexy pheromones going. I don't know.
I love it.
So we're very excited about it. It's kind of my entree into doing more virtual events. It's definitely going to be a lot of work. And obviously, I won't be having a traditional Valentine's Day because I'll be working. But right. I think I'm going to really enjoy it.
Your Valentine's Day is after when you're eating just, SpaghettiOs out of the can.
I know. You'd be surprised. Chefs do not eat nearly as fancy as what you see us put on social media or what we do at work because we're exhausted. So you could see us eating like ramen.
That's right. So Chloe, who I've watched a bunch of Chloe's videos where she shows people how to make meals for a dollar or something over in Scotland. This education is so important. People don't know how to make their finances work, especially now. It's amazing that you're doing this.
Here's it. Actually, this brings back to the point. About 3 weeks ago, we did a raffle for a family of four. A woman who had a family of, we did a raffle for a family. Mm-hmm. The woman who won had a family of four, three children, herself and her husband. Mm-hmm. And they won $200 worth of groceries. So my colleague and I, who works for me, we actually ended up going on Amazon Prime. I did three recipe cards for her. And then we went on Amazon Prime to make sure that she had everything for the recipes and then other basics like eggs and milk and, anything like that. And it was really freaking difficult to get the numbers and the quality at the way that we wanted to. I remember that a container of asparagus, fresh asparagus, was $5.
Wow.
Because that was in one of my dishes. Uh-huh. And I was like, dang, like all we're trying to do is feed people, but we have to keep it under, I think the limit was 250. We had to keep it under like 250 because the delivery was going to be expensive as well. Wow. And the cost of food has really risen. So you really have to be careful about when you're planning for your week, how you're going to take care of yourself, whether you're an individual or how you're going to support your family and overlap some of those ingredients. Just as we were saying before, we've talked about in restaurants, people writing menus where you overlap ingredients.
That's right. Carol said the same thing. Carol said that she's doing a meal prep system. It's all about reusing the ingredients efficiently in a healthy way, less waste and more affordable. So.
Oh, yes. People don't realize, don't throw away the chicken bones, make chicken broth, and then you can make a soup the following week. People are very waste. I recently found an app. I can't think of the name of it, but I can tell you later that actually you can get that restaurants, when they're throwing away waste, you can purchase it from them. And we're waste that's come from their walk-in fresh food that they would normally throw out by a certain date.
Right, right. So, super fun. Yum mashed potato with jalapeno sounds like heaven. Coach Woodard says it's an uphill battle educating folks on how expensive processed foods can be as opposed to more nutritious.
Yes. Diet. Especially, I noticed that people who are on the run, people who have children, tend to spend more money on processed foods because they feel like they don't have time.
Right. It's a time thing. Mm-hmm. But once you learn a couple shortcuts, it doesn't actually go that way, does it? You get a chance after you get a few shortcuts to make it work out.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, we were very much trying to tackle not just the mothers, but the children as well, and expose them to this is what nutritious food tastes like. Here are some other options outside of anything that has sugar. I mean, I'm not a big proponent of sugar at all. I've definitely learned through my skills how to cook things without it. Mm-hmm. And I'm also interested in teaching parents the same way. I mean, when people make tomato sauce or pasta sauce, it's always a ton of sugar. But if you put a carrot it takes out all the acidity where you don't need to add sugar.
I imagine your peach dessert. The peaches are a lot sweeter than people ever give them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Once you roast them, I've been roasting a lot of pears. You don't need sugar. I just think that it's so much in the forefront of how you think people cook that people add sugar to everything. And these kids don't need that. They're hyper enough.
They're wound up and going for it as it is.
Yeah.
Krista Lynch, this has been so cool. Thank you so much. If you can, stick around. I'm going to throw you backstage and we're going to pick up where we left off. But stick around. Thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Thank you for having me.
All righty. All right. I totally forgot ads. I told everybody backstage. I said, I'm going to totally forget to do ads. I'm 100% sure I'm going to do it. Which, by the way, what a great self-fulfilling prophecy when you say bad things. So Peter Nieves is coming on next, and I've got to talk to him. He's a lawyer. He's got some really cool projects and programs, also a minister. So first, I got to let you know that we are sponsored by PubSite, pub-site.com. When Krista writes her first book, which is right around the corner, she's going to make a website for it. It's going to be super easy, pub-site.com. You can get this thing up and running in a couple hours. It's free for 14 days, $19.99 a month thereafter. It takes all the guesswork out. You don't have to think about what you need to do to make an author site. This is FSB Associates, 25 years in the business of being book publicity people. Tom Clancy has his site on here. Robin Cook has their site on here. There's so many people who have a really cool author site thanks to PubSite. StreamYard, that's the show you're watching me on, cbrogan.me/StreamYard. If Peter wants to do law review for New Hampshire, he could do that. cbrogan.me/StreamYard. Just throw that show right on here. Super easy. Even a guy without his teammate can run the show almost as good. Not really. We're sponsored by Johnsonville. Yes, sausage makers, Johnsonville. If you want us to send you some sausage, talk about stretching the budget, Krista Lynch, you could get your own Johnsonville sausages. You just have to email Carrie Gorgon, carrie@chrisbrogan.com, and she'll send you out some sausages. You just owe us a video. We have a podcast, an audio podcast. It's really just this show in audio form. So if you got to walk Max, you can stick us in your ear. Castos.com is a podcasting host. They're new kids on the block, basically. There's other people who have done it differently. But Castos, I started using it to do our podcast, and it works super, super fast, super easy. No questions, problems, family jokes, or hardships. Everything's just swell. I'm grabbing Peter Nieves right now. I'm going to ask him a million billion questions. But what a day. Peter, welcome on board the show. How are you, good sir?
Hey, good morning, Chris. I got to tell you how impressed I am that you say my last name properly. I get Neves, Knives, Neves, Nieves. I can't tell you what I get, so I appreciate it.
I would have gone with Neves, you know, left to my own devices, but you have to ask.
There it is.
You have to know. But I worked in wireless telecom, and it was like thirds. So a third of the people were indigenous American born white people, a third of the people were Indian people, a lot who had just come from India. This was first stop on the game. Another third were Chinese people straight from China. And my coworkers didn't seem to want to learn people's names very well. And I always thought, it's not okay. Like it's just, your name is the first and most important thing you're given. And so
you are way more cultured than most, Chris. So that's part of it. So, yeah,
well, we're in New England, too. What are we going to do, Peter?
No, Jim.
I'm going to pull up your banners and all that sort of a thing. But, you know, talking through here, you run the patent law and intellectual property technology groups at Sheehan. You're an attorney and also a former adjunct professor at the UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law. I wanted to start there because you put together a scholarship program that features specifically on diversity. Can you talk a little bit about that and why that came to be?
Yeah, thanks for asking about this. So this is a pretty important issue. As you may know, because you're in Massachusetts, New Hampshire historically has not been a very diverse area. No. Over quite some time, right? And only, I'd say within the last like 20 or so years, it's become much more diverse. And I don't think many people realize that. So when you look at the New Hampshire population, you look at a predominantly white population. And so when you looked at the legal community for the historically predominantly white population, what you found was that the legal community kind of matched the community of individuals that were here, right? But when you look historically at what's been happening over the like last 20, 30 years, 15 years especially, is that you get a lot of people who are minorities who've been moving into this region. And historically, people think of minorities as individuals who may not have a lot of money. And that's not the case. I'm talking like the business owners, you know, the ones who are owning property, businesses, even separate from businesses, owning lots of, let's say, real estate, things like that, and starting up corporations. But at the same time, what you're finding is a lot of the large cities, you have these lower income areas where all of a sudden the properties are bought up and you get these penthouses that are being built. And so where are the people going to go? And so you have this in New York, you have in Massachusetts, you have it in Connecticut, you have it in New Jersey. And so the people are wondering, well, where are we going to go? And when you look at historically at New Hampshire, we in New Hampshire tend to have a very large elderly population. And historically, a lot of the students that would get an education in New Hampshire would then leave. And so what would happen is there'd be this gap, meaning that there's this big area where there's a lot of jobs available. because there's so many elderly and a lot of the youth are leaving. And so now that you're seeing this transformation where a lot of the youth are starting to realize, wow, New Hampshire is a great place. But at the same time, the number of minorities in New Hampshire has increased exponentially.
Right.
And I mean exponentially. And these become big business leaders and they're starting corporations. And so what does this have to do with the scholarship? Well, what I found was about maybe 8 months ago, I got a call from the dean of the University of New Hampshire Franklin Pierce Center of Law. And Dean Comforter, who is amazing, she's just truly amazing. She said, look, we have this issue where we want to increase the diversity within the student body. And so I said, well, let me join the task force. So we created this task force and we focused on things that we could implement to increase diversity within the student population, make it more appealing to people who are of a color, who are minorities in general. And so with that happening, one of the things that kept occurring to me was, well, what's going to make them want to come financially? Because when I look at a person like myself who grew up, you know, in like the projects of Brooklyn, over in Williamsburg before it became million-dollar penthouses, right? You know, back in the day when you were near the L. And so when you look at these individuals, like what's going to make them be able to afford law school? Because I don't know if people realize this. You're talking $120,000, $130,000, $140,000 at least to go to law school. So if we're trying to increase the legal communities, the population of minorities within the legal community that can serve the increasing minority population in the community in general, how are you going to do that if some of the minorities can't even afford to go to law school?
Right.
And so that got me thinking, well, hold it. Why don't we hit it at multiple areas? Why don't we hit it at the student area? Why don't we also hit it in the legal community, like provide opportunities to actually increase the number of lawyers who are Black and Hispanic? I mean, if you have a population of, I'll give you one example. About 2 years ago, a very nice woman who ran into me at an event said, look, I need a family lawyer. And I said, I don't do family law. Like, you know, I'm an electrical engineer by trade. I do patent law. I'm a litigator, a prosecutor. I've litigated in many different states. And so I said, I can't help you. And she says, but I really need help. And so I said, okay, well, I'm going to get you a family lawyer. And she says, is he Hispanic? And I said, I don't know any Hispanic family lawyers. And right. She said, well, will you go into the meeting with me? Now, that was heart-wrenching. Like, because she was in a serious situation with her son, okay. Right? Which involved custody and some issues that happened with him. And I said, sure. And so I brought her to this attorney who was outstanding. I mean, phenomenal family lawyer, but he was Caucasian. She was so uncomfortable because she felt like he couldn't relate to her family unit, like the grandparents being in the same home as her and her family, you know, what the communication was like, you know, she didn't feel like he could understand that. So my just being in the room helped calm her down so she could actually receive what this outstanding lawyer was trying to tell her, but she wasn't willing to receive it because he wasn't like her.
Right. Now, that's an interesting point. I want to anecdote on top of that a little bit, which is that, so my ex, Jacqueline, she was Brazilian and Brazilian and Puerto Rican. And when I met her Puerto Rican relatives, she was a competitive bodybuilder and we were at a bodybuilding show that was not that far from her aunt's house, TT Nancy. Well, TT Nancy, I meet TT Nancy for the first time and I don't remember his name, but I'll make one up. She's like, hi, I'm TT Nancy. And I'm like, so good to meet you. She goes, this is my ex-husband, Eduardo. And I'm like, hello, ex-husband. And then Jack is kind of making a face at me. She goes, Latin households are very different than white people households.
Absolutely.
You learn quick. And I was like, okay.
Absolutely.
And but you just made that point. You said Grammy and Gramps lived there. You know, there's a very big different family dynamic there, and it's important.
Right. Yeah. And so what I found in this situation was, how do we make it more resources available for these individuals? Where, I mean, as an example, in I believe 2014, I think there were two or three Black students out of like 130. Wow. I mean, these are the kind of things and it's not like the law school is not looking for them. They're trying to provide the opportunities. It's just, when you look at a person like myself, Puerto Rican, I never even heard of patent law. Like, nobody ever told me that it existed. I actually worked at a restaurant. I worked three jobs while I was in college because my family didn't have the money to put me in college or law school. And right. so while I'm working three jobs, I think I was 2 months away from graduation. And I was miserable going into an electrical engineering career. And one of the waiters turns to me and says, "What is your problem? You're pissing me off." And I said, "Why?" And Michael just said, "You know, you're going to graduate, make good money as an electrical engineer." And I said, "But I'm bored. Like, I like to do new things all the time. Like, I need a new environment." And he turned to me and he said, "Have you ever heard of patent law?" And I said, "What's patent law?" So I applied to the number one law school in the world for patent law, which was then Franklin Pierce Law Center, and got in. But that shows you that the educational institution is not built to actually provide the exposure in many situations for minorities to understand there's a thing called patent law, there's law in general, like there's these other opportunities besides just engineering, besides just, you know, these cookie cutter known careers. And so I
want to go back on something. Just one quick question. Did you say this is a dishwasher at the restaurant told you this, or a guy at the restaurant told you this?
Right? One of the waiters.
One of the waiters.
Yeah.
That's where you learned about patent law.
Exactly. His brother-in-law was a patent attorney and his name's Michael. And I give God thanks for the career, but I also give Michael thanks for the career.
That's right.
I think he was strategically used because I literally was going to go to grad school. And so I went into a hallway at the dorms and I said, "All right, Lord, I'm going to apply to one school, the number one law school in the world. And if I get in," and my grades were not outstanding, by the way, because I was working three jobs to just get through college, right, to be able to afford it. And they asked for an interview and I got in. And so I said to myself, I didn't have the resources to get into an outstanding law school. What if we provided an environment, if we're trying to increase the minority population of attorneys to take care of minorities within the community in New Hampshire, why not increase the number of students in New Hampshire that are minorities? And how can you do that? Well, let's create a scholarship program, which did not exist. So I took a portion of my own money, put it in, and began the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Scholarship Program with the dean and with the law school. And that's taken off. I'm trying to get 200,000 in there so that every year, two or three minority students will have $15,000 to $20,000 available to go through their tuition immediately to give them that opportunity that I didn't have and that many others don't have.
That's not often what one thinks about when one thinks of lawyers, Peter. And so I kind of want to throw another nod down on top of this, that you also are a minister for the less fortunate. You're doing a lot of work in ministry as well. Want to talk about how we mix a little bit of God into this experience?
Wow. Wow, that's an outstanding question. I'll give a story because I find Jesus spoke in Proverbs, which was amazing. So I tend to speak in stories a lot. So I'll just give you this one story. It was about 2 years ago. I was in a really powerful patent litigation matter. It was worth tens of millions of dollars, right? It was up there. It was a lot of money that was on the line on this. Opposing counsel was out of Massachusetts, very aggressive. And he was, I'd hate to say it, but as most legal counsel, was sarcastic, condescending, you know, rude on one of the calls. And we had a meet and confer, and it was really nasty. And afterwards, it was one of those calls that when you get off, you want to bathe. Like, it was literally like that. And so I'm going to get a little spiritual here. But what happened was I hung up the phone and I literally felt in my spirit, call him up, like call him up. And I said, well, what? I can't call him. He's opposing counsel. He's one of my most important clients, bringing lots of money to the firm. But something was off. And so I put it off and I couldn't even focus on my work for so long. Then all of a sudden, I said, I can't call him up because we're going to have issues. Then finally, I came to it. I called him. He didn't answer it. And what happened was I said, okay, Lord, I tried. I tried, God. You know, I'm done for the day. So I went home. That was a Friday. Came back on a Saturday, tried to focus on work, and I couldn't again. Again, I couldn't. And so what happened was I said, all right, I'm going to call him. I tried reaching him. I got his voicemail. I said, can you please call me? This is extremely important. All right. He texts me and he says he's at a lacrosse tournament with his daughter. Can I call you back? I said, sure. He calls me back. He says, what's up, Pete? I said, look, and actually before I actually called him, I looked him up on the internet. He's actually a deacon at his church. So all of a sudden it made sense why the Lord was guiding me to call him, right? So when we got on the phone, I said, look, we are both leaders in the legal community. We are both, you know, men of God. And I got to tell you, like, while we're in this world, we're not of the world. If the way we work is the same way that everybody else works, then who in the world is going to want to be Christian? Honestly, it's like, if you look like everybody else, why am I going to do what you're doing? Like, why? So our conversation went on, and afterwards, he was so grateful, and I received a word of knowledge on him and a word of wisdom, and I knew what was going on with his daughters, prayed over him, his daughters, his wife. He went through a physical healing on the phone call. Like, pain literally came off him like that. But what it was about was, the word says that we're to love the Lord our God with all our heart, mind, soul, and strength, and to love our neighbor as ourselves. And what people don't realize is that word love, right, is agapeo. That means it's the same word love where it says God so loved the world that he gave his one and only begotten son, right? That word love is a divine love, a godly love. That's the way he loved us. And then it says love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. That's the same word, agapeo. That means we're to love God with the same godly love. But as it goes on, it says the second most important commandment is to love your neighbor as yourself. It's the same word. It's agapeo. That means I am supposed to love you and to love every single other person on this earth the exact same way that God loves me, that he would give his one and only beloved son for me. Now, if I live my life like that, even in litigation, then what will happen is, all of a sudden, I'll be representing my client instead of my interest. The pride and ego will decrease. The animosity will decrease. All of a sudden, I don't get triggered by the single words that you say. I don't get upset because you're upset. I could lead you into resolution faster, and I can take care of my client faster. That's what it's about. That's what Christianity is about. It's not about, you know, I always say religion is really it's a voyage in pride on behalf of individuals who misrepresent God. That's kind of how I look at it, right? Religion is what's supposed to happen is it's supposed to be an individual, personal, intimate relationship with God directly. You don't need another person, right? I mean, there's Jesus Christ, you and God, right? Now, if there's another person who wants to guide you, great. But when you bring this into the legal community, what it means is you represent people with humility. You seek the other what the other person is seeking. You try to understand it better, and you let go of your pride. You let go of your ego. And what I find is that I get better results all the time. Like, my clients are consistently being taken care of. I'm not, quite frankly, I mean, I want to remain humble here, right? But I have a really good history in court. I'll just leave it at that.
Well, I was going to ask that question. I was going to ask, if you're the one guy playing with that high hand, you know, do you get thumped a lot for it? And you're saying, no, you turned out okay.
It really works out well. And in fact, opposing counsel in that case 2 years ago, he called me up personally. Not only did he thank me, like, mm-hmm. profusely for praying for him and his daughter and knowing what was going on in their life, but he also, right after that, our demeanor towards each other completely changed. So much so that the judge even said, what is going on? When we were arguing in front of the judge literally, like, opposing counsel, he turns and he says, I think Mr. Nieves has something to say on this point. And the judge looks at him and says, what's going on here? Like, what is happening here? And so what's actually happening is you're allowing the love of God to come through you towards others. But that does not mean I'm not an outstanding lawyer and I'll win in court. And it doesn't mean that I'm not an incredible electrical engineer. It just means that I allow myself to be moved through love. And that love is not like teddy bears and, you know, and kittens. Love is very powerful. Love is the same thing that will allow a mother to lift a car off her son. Mm-hmm. That's what love is. So love is not just the soft, touchy-feely things. It's also very powerful. And so I think as we get to know the Lord differently, we'll understand that he's been misrepresented for so long. And he just wants a direct relationship with us. And once that happens, your life just changes. Like, I was freed from so many things, physically healed, emotionally healed. And I try to bring that to other people, not only in my representation of them, but also with the homeless and in other capacities.
It's impressive. There's a lot of stuff we could dig into. I'm grabbing Krista Lynch back. We're going to bring her on. Who'd have known that you had restauranting in common, that you had Brooklyn in common?
Yeah, I heard Williamsburg.
The Williamsburg before all the wax mustaches and the artisan cheese.
No kidding. We didn't use the subway back there at like 3 in the morning.
It's not even Williamsburg now. It's Crown Heights. It's Bed-Stuy. No. It's all these areas that look completely different. I moved to New York 17 years ago, and nothing looks the same as 17 years ago. So imagine if I grew up here.
That's exactly right. It's totally different. I mean, to see, I saw a group of three young women walking around at 1 in the morning in the street. And I thought, that never would have happened back in the day.
I had a tour of Williamsburg about 3 or 4 years ago by way of a guy who was doing some of the development part of things and helping with the hotel businesses out there and that sort of a thing. And I was quite surprised. I was quite surprised by all the gentrification. And to Peter's point, though, what that does is that pushes people, you know, who don't have those kind of means
completely out.
Places.
Yeah.
Changes everything, makes crazy, you know, for all those restaurants that are in places like Brooklyn now, it's amazing that there are still these kind of food deserts in the city. Mm-hmm. And my boy Desus and Mero are out there still really representing the bodega life. But, you know, like you said, it's an expensive life. You can't live life out of that bodega.
It's true. And I think that's what's led to a lot of the people moving to New Hampshire, you know, and great opportunities. New Hampshire's beautiful. I mean, I'm looking outside my door at a frozen lake. You know, snow covered, absolutely pristine. Bald eagle flies by every once in a while. Hawks. I mean, it's incredible, right? And so people are moving here, but the opportunities have to come. And so I applaud what Krista's doing too. I mean, just amazing work that you're doing on your behalf, you know, and just applaud your efforts, you know. And it's, we need to provide, as we as individuals have been blessed, we need to provide the avenue for others to be able to be lifted up too, because if you get lifted up by yourself, it's going to be really lonely by yourself. Some people like that. I personally don't. I like to lift up others as well. And clearly Krista does as well. And Chris, yes. I've seen you historically do, because I've seen your show. So kudos
me,
to you.
Not at all. I'm selfish and greedy and, you know, completely broken. So Kate says she lived in Nashua for 2 years. Nashua is an interesting part of New Hampshire for darn sure. New Hampshire is one of my favorite places to visit, says Trader Leslie. Look, if you're born and raised in Maine, you can't say nice things about New Hampshire, Leslie. Don't make me come over there. in Maine, we just call New Hampshire that place almost on the way to Massachusetts, but it's wonderful. You know, it's like, you know, there's like, you know, Yankees, Mets kind of a thing. It's, you know, it's like that.
I'm a Yankees fan, by the way.
See how this goes, Peter. This is going, I'm losing everything. No, it's fine. I didn't like baseball enough to care. But one question I have for both of you. There's sort of two ministries going on here. Krista's ministering to the body right now. She's saying you got to eat in a certain way, and you got to, mm-hmm. you know, you're going to get your soul because you're going to get fed here. I'll give you the fish. Peter, you're teaching people to fish at the same time. Talk a little bit about, how do you get people to feel that sense of ministry without feeling that sense of someone telling you that they're better or telling you that they know what's right for you and that sort of feeling?
That's an incredible question. Go ahead, Krista. That's an incredible question.
No, I think that, I mean, it's definitely hard. I think you've got to bring yourself down to the level of you're having a conversation with this person. You're not, and not give them the idea that you're trying to educate them because you have more education to them or because you have more resources than them. I think it's coming, developing a common ground, whatever that might be.
Outstanding.
That's the entree into having a conversation about something like this, because you don't want the person to feel like you're better than them. That immediately closes the door. That's when people stop, they tune you out, they can't hear anything else you want to say if they feel like you're making them feel less than.
Jesus preferred to hang out with Magdalene, and Jesus liked hanging out with the people doing the, you know, the worst things going on. Then he spent most of his time with sort of scholars and the Pharisees and all that. Peter, what's your version of the answer?
Yeah, my answer would really be humility. I mean, it was about 3 years ago, I was in a really difficult week, like very difficult week. And fortunately, I'm blessed with this lake house. And so I decided in the middle of the day to go out on the lake. like where nobody else is around. And people know that during the week, the lakes are just nobody. It's just quiet. So I came out here, got on the boat, still had my suit on from work, still have my shoes on, grab my fishing rod, go out in the middle of the lake. And I'm trying to relax and I'm a little bit stressed and the wind's blowing. And I said, you got to be kidding me. They're like, there's no clouds in the sky. The sun is perfect. It should be warm. It should be like, I was getting a little perturbed here. Like, what's going on here? And so I have a window there. So I kneel down. So the window is supposed to block the wind. And I cast again and the wind comes and hits me. So I'm getting a little upset here. I close the window to the area so that hopefully the wind won't hit me. Somehow the wind goes up around the window and hits me in the neck. So I do one of these, literally. I do one of these, and I do one of these, and I'm fishing like this. And it's a pristine day. And as I'm fishing, the wind somehow hits me again, and I hear my spirit go into the boat and sit on the floor. So I don't know what that means, but I put down the fishing rod, I open the window, I go in, and I sit on the floor, which is the lowest place on the entire boat, the exact lowest area. And when I sit there, I'm hit with the warmth of the sun. There's no wind. There's nothing. There's just peace. And all my stress just disappears. And I heard the Lord say, I had to bring you low so I could give you what you want. And when you get that reality, that living in humility, understanding that everything that you have is a blessing, it's a gift, you really couldn't have accomplished all these things. I know people who have degrees like me who are homeless. You know, and so when you realize that, then you can best represent other individuals because your pride and your ego will be maintained at bay. And then you'll be able to be an outstanding person owning a restaurant, outstanding telecaster, outstanding lawyer, because your interests take second place. And when that happens, a lot can happen very fast.
I like your answers, both of you. We are nearing the end of the show. I've got two more things I got to do.
Oh, and here's our person of the day. Kaboom!
I was looking through my person of the day, and she couldn't even make it here yesterday. She had other business going on. And so Kate is person of the day. I like this particular quote about thanking God for Michael for listening and being pissed off at you, caring enough for you to recommend. That was during Peter's conversation with the waiter, Michael. Now we're at the one last question I ask every single guest who's ever been on there, including Sister Ann Flanagan from the Daughters of St. Paul, all the way to Dr. Sunny, who is a sex therapist. We ask the question, what goes in your backpack? Could be something physical, could be something metaphorical. DJ Cummerbund, who is a mix DJ, he makes cool mixes. He said an extra set of teeth. He's really into pro wrestling, and he said you never know if you're going to need another set of teeth. There's just been so many great ones. Horacio Garcia Rojas from Mexico City, he's an actor. He said pride in where you come from. He was not ever going to just be an LA actor. He was going to be a Mexico City actor who sometimes worked for Hollywood. So you get to add something to the backpack. One thing, if you can, physical or metaphorical. Krista Lynch, what do you got?
For me, after this year in the hospitality industry, it would be the ability to pivot. Just constantly pivoting to acclimate yourself to the current times. I've had to pivot my business about 3 times, and I probably see more pivots coming as we see the layout of what this landscape of hospitality is going to be looking like over the next year.
I like pivot. I'll put that in there. I think that's a great one. Attorney Peter Nieves, tell me what goes into the backpack for you, good sir.
And it has to be one thing, or can it be two?
Let's try them.
Okay. So for me, honestly, it would be Holy Spirit and it would be humility, quite frankly, because Holy Spirit brings the power, brings the love, so you can accomplish the things that you're trying to do in humility.
I think those are two perfect answers. There was one request from the audience that I say avocado, because that's my favorite thing that I ever got put in. It was clown, Saida Trujillo. From the Clowns Without Borders, a humanitarian clown group who does exactly what you would imagine. They fly into war-torn regions and help people laugh. She said an avocado, because you just never know what you need to eat something a little extra. I always think if they ever rewrote the Bible to be just a wee bit more believable today, when they get to that 7 fishes, I think it should be more like a Puerto Rican mom, because it should be like rice and beans, because you can feel like... 900,000 people with a little bit more rice or just a little bit more beans.
You got it. Yeah.
I don't think fish is a stretchy food. That's what I'm saying when I say that.
That's what makes it miraculous.
And there you go. That's right.
For avocados, that's the one thing that you can say. It's always wait, too late. That's the one thing about avocados.
Talk about humility. It's humility right on your stupid countertop. So, and talk about food waste. That's why nobody wants to buy an avocado. My grandmother was a pretty darn good cook and a very devout Catholic. So I was born and raised Catholic. But one of the things I didn't get in church that I did get at learning how to cook was that if you...